Welcome back to the Ramble Room, my friends. I'm flying solo tonight. That's not fair. I shouldn't say I'm flying solo, because when you have a friend of some 35 plus years with you, you're never alone. Bob, it's great to have you here.
Hey, thanks, Ken. It's good to be with you.
Yes, this is my friend Bob Winnie. We first met sometime in the mid-80s, I don't know, 85, 86. We had just joined the National Guard. Now, Bob had some prior service, so he came in with some stripes on his shoulder, which I was envious of. We did our first weekend, and the way I remember it, we did our first weekend, what do you call it, a Muta 4, Muta 5?
Yeah. Well, Muta 5 is a Friday night inclusive.
Yeah.
Muta 4 is just Saturday, Sunday.
It might have been a Friday night, because I remember there were some silver bullets involved.
It could have been.
It's
possible. That happens from time to time.
It's possible. I remember some other things that used to happen there, which we'll probably just let lie.
Yeah, we'll leave that alone.
But Bob and I hit it off right away, and we'd been in the Guard about 6 months, to my reckoning. This goes back a long way, so I may not be accurate anymore. But things in Casper, Wyoming at that point, the economy was in pretty bad shape, and I felt I had little choice but to just go to regular Army, to go full-time. Bob helped me make that decision. He told me a little bit about what his experiences had been at Fort Carson, so I tried to get a deal to Fort Carson, which I did. But anyway, long story short, I went to Fort Carson, and the recruiter lied to me. Can you believe that?
I can't. That's rare that would ever happen.
Yeah, he told me that you will get your orders in, as I remember it, April or May, somewhere in there. And so long about a week or two before the orders were supposed to come in, I went ahead and quit my job, thought I'd spend a little bit of time with my family. And the orders came in, and they said, report to Denver in October.
During deer season, which is wrong.
It ought to be a federal offense, yes.
Yeah.
But anyway, here I am. It's springtime. I have a young bride and two little children. Now,
You just had Seth at that time, I think.
Yeah, that's right. Because she was pregnant with Charlie. Yeah, because you're correct. See, your memory's better than mine, because you're a younger man, probably.
Yeah, probably.
You have it your way. Anyway, long story short, it was a tough summer. I started cutting firewood up on the mountain. I hawked some saddles to buy a chainsaw. And Bob loaned me this trailer, which probably had a normal, you weren't supposed to put over 1,200 pounds or so on it. And I probably put 3,000 pounds on it every load.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway.
It was abused.
It was. And I was pulling it behind a 1946 Chevrolet 2-ton truck that had bad brakes. So Bob got with our neighbor Dan and helped me redo the brakes. He helped me rebuild the engine, all kinds of things that he did. And I cannot possibly thank you enough, Bob, for helping me out there. By the time the autumn came around, it was time for me to go to the Army. I'd been bucking firewood all summer. I was in great shape. Went down to basic training, Fort Jackson, South Carolina. And one of the first things that happened to me was the drill sergeant said, knock out 10, and I did it one-handed.
Oops. And then he knew, this is the guy I'm going to pick on from now on.
Yeah, I singled myself out. But anyway, over that time, and Bob and I have been in and out of touch, but we've been back in touch recently, and one of the greatest guys that I've ever been around. And I'm going to let Bob introduce himself and tell you a little bit about his career, where he went from there. He stuck with the National Guard, but rose to great revered heights. And Bob, just tell the folks a little bit about your career, who you are, what you did. Tell us a little bit about Afghanistan.
Okay, I will. I'm Bob Winnie. I currently live and have for almost 30 years now in south of Douglas, Converse County, Wyoming. I joined the Guard, I think it was in 84, after and just a few months short of an 8-year hitch with the regular Army active duty. And I got out of the Army in 1979, decided that those 8 years really didn't need to go to waste, and I thought I could put them to good use with the Guard and join the Guard and stayed with them for 28 more years. And
by the way, I hate to interrupt you, but while you were at Fort Carson, you were part of an elite unit.
I was in the 1st Squadron 10th Cav, and it was one of the original Buffalo Soldier Cav squadrons back in the day during the Indian Wars time. And then for about the last year I was in the active duty at Fort Carson, I was in the 1st to 10th Cav Mounted Color Guard, and we traveled all over the Western United States presenting the colors at rodeo grand entries and on little town parades in La Junta, Colorado, and Alamosa. And we did a week at Cheyenne Frontier Days in 1979, just had a great time. And then in November of 79, I got out of the Army and went on my own way.
So that was kind of the quintessential dog and pony show stuff.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
But your tales of that, and you're talking about working with the horses, were part of what enticed me to go ahead and go regular Army. And when I got to Fort Carson, one of the first things I did is go down and see these guys.
Uh-huh.
And the more I talked to them about what they did, I thought, well, that may not be for me, and I'm glad I didn't. But I say that to thank you for what you did, because there is something about esprit de corps. There's something about morale. There's something about what poets have called the noble lie that lifts up the responsibility of the soldier. When we stepped off, when I got back from Desert Storm and we stepped off the plane, and they had the Third IDs band there, and we walked onto the red carpet, there was not a dry eye in the place. We were all bawling.
Oh, absolutely.
And the things that you did in that color guard, the things that you did in that mounted cav, did more to help the Army and the spirit of that than anyone could ever tell. So I wanted to pull that a little bit aside. Thank you for doing that. Thank you for being an inspiration for me to go and do what I later did, which I never regretted for a second.
Yeah. it's all good in hindsight.
It is. When you start looking at the details, it gets a little more bitter, but there's a way of looking back at it, and you just remember the good times, and that's, I guess maybe that's God's gift of grace to an old soldier.
Yeah, it is.
So anyway,
that's what you remember.
You left Fort Carson, you left the regular Army in 79, and then a few years later, 84, 85, which is about when I met you, you joined the National Guard. Take it up from there.
I did. I was an E5 buck sergeant, and I joined the Service Battery 3rd Battalion, 49th Artillery, that had a detachment in Casper, which is where I lived at the time.
You had the best VTR driver.
We had a VTR, which was a vehicle tracked recovery. It's basically a smaller recovery.
It's like a howitzer, but instead of a gun, it has a crane on it.
Yeah, and that's what I did when I was in the cab. So I was, I drove one of those many miles, and had a lot of good memories doing that. It's fun, man. It's a blast. I mean, that's kind of blue collar, get dirty kind of fun. But I'm talking about some serious fun, and it's a good time. And you're accomplishing a mission and having fun at the same time. So yeah, it was great. Anyway, from there on, I went to work full time for the Guard then in June of 87, and I worked in the maintenance field, worked in Guernsey for a while, worked at the organizational shop, stayed with them full time in the maintenance world for, I don't know, 20 some years, and retired from that in in 2011, but I stayed, I retired from the full-time position, but stayed on the M-Day position, which is, you know, on the military side. So I was just a traditional guardsman at that time. I just had my weekend commitments and things like that, but I was retired and home every day. So then in 2013, I finally retired from the Guard. I went all the way up to Command Sergeant Major E9. When I retired, I deployed twice federally, once to Afghanistan in 2006, once to Kuwait in 2009. I deployed a couple times at the state level for fires. Actually was a firefighter, had the red card, and fought fires up around Indian Kara, over there by Hewlett, over there east of Gillette. And then another fire one time, a couple weeks out around Fontenelle. And just doing the Guard state duty, you know, that was fun too. But
it was, and now that you mention that, I'm reminded that we drove truck supporting a fire way back in 84, 85.
Yeah, we probably did.
We were hauling beans and water. Yep. Actually, it wasn't beans; it was steaks.
Troops. We used to haul the firefighters in the mornings and then pick them up in the evenings,
yep,
you know, up the fire line and
yep,
in the back of a 5-ton or a deuce and a half.
I remember doing that. It was an interesting time. So tell me about this Afghanistan stint. What did you see? Where were you at? What do you gather from that?
Let me start from the beginning here in Wyoming. I was a first sergeant for the second time in 2006 at the 115th Brigade Headquarters Battery down in Cheyenne. And an RFF, which is a request for fill, came down from Department of Defense and Department of the Army, requesting for a 25-man maintenance contingency to deploy with the 207th Infantry Brigade out of Alaska. That really caught my attention, and I wanted to step up and do that. So myself and 25 other courageous Wyoming soldiers volunteered and stepped up and took that on. And we went to Alaska in April of 2006, I believe it was. Yeah, April. And we did our MOB training right there at Fort Richardson in just north of Anchorage. And then in... I believe it was June 3rd of 2006, we touched down in Kandahar Airfield and stayed there until late May of 2007 and returned back to Fort Richardson, did our demob, got back home on June 8th of 2007. When I got to Alaska, I was a first sergeant. I was a diamond-wearing E-8. And they already had a first sergeant. So I told the sergeant major, it was a sergeant major Pam Harrington, a female, great person. God, I love her. And I told her that, you know, you can do whatever you want with me. Put me wherever you want. Make me a master sergeant instead of a first sergeant. Well, she said, I don't think we can do that. We don't have that kind of administrative control over you to do anything like that. But what we were thinking is maybe let you be our first sergeant. So I, you know, what do you say? You know, you you say, I guess, you know, sure, I would love to. So
I don't think I've ever heard you when given a challenge, ever back down. I guess that's how I'd put it. Whether it be a stupid dare, like let's play horseshoes in the dark. And we'll tape glow sticks to the pins, and you be the guy that stands behind the pin and round up all the horseshoes in the dark.
While drinking beer, of course.
Only in small quantities.
Small quantities, yeah. At a controlled time. Controlled environment.
At
controlled
a time. Quantities. Anyway, sorry, a little diverted.
But anyway, yeah. So anyway, I deployed then as Well, went all through mobilization training for 2 months there in Alaska, and that entire year as the first sergeant for a 116-man unit. It was the headquarters company of the 297th Brigade Support Battalion. And we were charged with maintaining and controlling all levels of supply in Regional Command South, RC South, which is a division of the Afghanistan battlefield, if you will. So by all classes of supply, I mean class one, clothing, two, food and water, three, five, ammunition, eight, medical, nine, repair parts. We maintained and managed all of the supply for the entire RC South in Kandahar for a year.
Don't underestimate this, folks. That's a big job.
It was huge.
Yeah.
But, we had...
The guy that carries the guns on the front lines certainly is admirable, is carrying a burden. But the guy that makes sure that he's fed, that makes sure that he has everything that he needs, those are indispensable as well, and I just never want to diminish that.
No, it is huge. But, we had guardsmen, and guardsmen are so... versatile and can do so many things, a plethora of tasks. What I'm trying to say is, we had guys whose MOS, their military occupational specialty, was a radio repairman. But in his full-time job at home, he's a plumber,
yeah,
or a carpenter, or an electrician,
or a welder,
yeah, manages a financial institute, or it's just, so you put guys where they can be used best, regardless of their MOS. And the regular Army guys that we were replacing with just didn't understand that. We provided them with our roster of where we were putting people, and you can't put him in there. He's a 45.
Yeah,
he's a 45 Bravo small arms repairman. You got him working in a radio repair shop. Yeah, well, because he owns a radio shop down in Torrington. He does that for a living, so. Yeah.
Right.
And, they just couldn't catch on to that. But, with that kind of skills available, the Guard really has it over the Army, because the Army is pretty, they pretty much have blinders on their tunnel vision. This is my job. This is what I do. I can't do your job. I just do my job.
We don't have union cards, but I remember regular Army, this that's exactly it. This is what I do, this is what I don't do. And if you have any other skills, you hide them, because
yeah,
you don't want to be pulled out of formation.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, then we redeployed in late May of 2006, and I was still the first sergeant, and the majority of the people still liked me. And those that didn't matter.
That's an accomplishment.
I was on top of the world. And I came home and I tried to explain my feelings and emotions to my wife. And she said, oh, that's like a Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Mm. And I said, oh, and we've got to talk about that a little bit. And I remembered that from college classes, years and years ago. So, yeah, it is, because I was at the pinnacle. I was at the peak. I had accomplished everything at that point in my life that I had ever aspired to achieve, and I was on top of the world. I really felt good. But what comes along with providing all classes of supply to a whole region of a battlefield, a battle zone, war zone, is convoys and logistics. Supply routes. And so we had guys out almost daily getting blown up and shot at and delivering supplies to the outreach FOBs and COBs around the country.
Okay, take just a second. What's a FOB? What's a COB?
FOB is a forward operating base, and COB escapes me right now. I can't remember. But it's basically... It's basically it's a forward operating base. It's just they renamed it for whatever reason. Yeah.
The military is full of little things like that. Every acronym means something, and I hear you. Having been a part of field artillery and armor for quite a while, there are little terms that we use, and somebody will kind of stop me and say, "What's that mean?" And say, yeah. "I don't know. It's what it is."
Yeah, it's just what it is.
Yeah.
Exactly. So yeah, we had a lot of guys out in danger. We had we lost a few couple soldiers. God bless them. And had a very good friend of mine involved in an IED, and he went to. I'll never forget it. It happened on the 15th of January, 2007, at about 4 o'clock in the morning. And I flew with him from Kandahar Air Base to Landstuhl at the big regional medical center, Army Medical Center in Germany. He spent about 2 days there and was evac'd back to Walter Reed. He was still at Walter Reed when I returned in June. I got here home from my deployment on June 8th, and Vicky and I were standing at his bedside in Walter Reed on June 18th. I couldn't get there fast enough to present him with his Purple Heart and everything that comes with all that stuff. And it was an honor.
Yeah, absolutely, Bob. I know that's tough. 6 months of struggle. A lot of people have a picture of what an Army Command Sergeant Major or even an Army Drill Sergeant. You know what makes a good drill sergeant? Love.
Yeah.
If you genuinely love your troops and you want to give them everything that you possibly can so that they can survive in a god-awful situation, it requires love.
It does, absolutely.
And I've known in my 10 years of service and a number of other years being associated, I've known a number of non-commissioned officers, I've known a number of commissioned officers. If you're going to be any good at that job, you have to love people. And what you just heard from Bob and in his voice was love. Thank you.
Yes, sir. So anyway, that was basically my Afghanistan experience. I had a great bunch of people. Still friends. I mean, it's a brotherhood when you
Absolutely. When you
spend the time in your life with those people. They're attached to you forever.
You remember people saying things like, when the good Lord calls me in, he can't send me to hell because I've already been there.
Yeah.
that kind of an attitude. And we all know that that's kind of superficial. But
yeah.
A lot of us, and, you know, maybe my listeners don't necessarily know my history. I am a Desert Storm veteran. I spent 6 months in combat there. Did what I did, came back, got my little ribbons on my chest, felt good, got the red carpet treatment. All of that is well and good.
Yeah.
But the love that is shared between those of us who went through that is incomparable. You can't explain it. You can't replace it. It is what it is. You can't describe it. It just is. So with that, Bob, I say thank you so much for your service, for your dedication, for everything that you did in trying to preserve the lives of these young men. And remarkably, you had very few, I'm really struggling, because I look at what happened the last couple of days ago where 13 soldiers, including a kid from Jackson Hole,
yeah,
lost their lives for no damn reason.
No good reason.
None.
any, certainly was avoidable.
Absolutely avoidable. And Bob, I wanted to get a little bit of your reaction to how you feel about what's happening now. I don't know that it's even describable.
It's not really. I've been watching it. I mean, I can't pull myself away from it. And I need to. But when they pulled out of Bagram Airfield in the middle of the night,
what was that about?
What kind of coward does that?
And don't even tell our allies. We don't even tell our friends. We just disappear.
No, the Afghan nationals on the airbase in the morning got up and thought, what the heck? Where'd everybody go? What's up with this? The sad thing is they left their equipment in place and got on airplanes and left.
Giving the Taliban an Air Force.
And gave the Taliban an Air Force base that was already furnished and ready to go. And then, a few weeks later, then this stuff all starts, and they go back and reclaim the airfield at Kabul.
With their first line of defense, their first line of defense is the Taliban themselves.
Yeah.
And they give them a list of people we need to. What the hell are they thinking?
That's so sad. I have to laugh.
Because if you can't, it would kill you.
Our intelligence people think that was ever a good idea? I'm baffled.
The quintessential definition of an oxymoron is military intelligence.
Yeah. Well, these weren't military guys. This was the CIA.
Exactly. Yeah. These were civilians. And the thing that keeps coming back to me, and I'm not asking you to commit to what I think, these people can't be that stupid. This is evil.
I don't know.
Yeah. Well,
I think they're elitist type people that think we'll just do this and everything will be yummy.
Can't we all just get along?
Kumbaya.
What was it that Barack Obama did with dropping pallet loads of cash? Yeah. The whole problem is climate change, so they're suffering, and racism, and blame it on all of this. And if we just appease them enough, they'll be nice to us. No, the fact of the matter is, they will take every dime you give them, they will take every bullet you give them, they will take every drone, they will take every Humvee, they will take everything that you give them, and then turn around and use it directly against you.
They will take everything you give them and then kill you.
Yes.
And, you know, in Afghanistan, their allegiance is to no one. Their allegiance is to, they're out in those little mud huts. They're the type of people that will kill you for a chicken because I can eat it today. And then if somebody else goes in there, you know, or if you give them a chicken, okay, yo, I'll be your friend today. I'll tell you where the Taliban's hiding because he gave me a chicken. Well, then the next day, the Taliban goes and gives them a nanny goat that's producing milk and a kid that they can barbecue. Oh, shit, excuse my friends. The army guys, they're right over there. Thank you for the goat.
Yeah.
So, you know, they have no allegiance to anyone. They'll do whatever it is so that they can survive that day and live on to the next day to make another deal with somebody else.
In the spring of 1980, when I was a senior in high school, Russia invaded Afghanistan. And when I came home from school that day, there was a note laying on my bed, a note from my father. And it was a quote from Rudyard Kipling. And the quote says, when you're wounded and left on Afghanistan's plain and the women, children come out to cut what remains, just roll to your rifle and blow out your brains and go to your God as a soldier. And I had never really thought about that kind of a culture before. That cutthroat, the cutthroat sort of thing that is that has been going on in Afghanistan since God only knows when.
Oh yeah.
Russia went in there, dicked around for, excuse my French now, screwed around for 10, 12 years or whatever, went out with their tail between their legs.
Yes, they did.
We went in there half-ass. Folks, if you're going to go to war, you go to war. If you're not willing to go to war, if you're not willing to do what it takes to win the battle, get the hell out. Nobody is saying, nobody is blaming Trump. Nobody is blaming, nobody in their right mind, I should say, is blaming the current administration. And I hesitate to call it the Biden administration because we know for sure that he's not in charge. Nobody is blaming them for getting out of Afghanistan.
No.
What we're blaming them for is the cowardice, the traitorism, the flagrant incompetence in running out of this place with our tail between our legs and completely destroying our posture, our position, our leverage over any nation, anywhere, at any time.
In the world.
Yes, I have never in my life seen America brought to its knees like this. I witnessed, via TV, I witnessed the fall of Saigon.
As did I and lots of folks.
And I thought that was as bad as it could ever get. I was mistaken.
You were mistaken, my friend, and I'm sorry for that.
Yes. So where do we go from here? Any ideas?
I don't know, man. We got to, first of all, we got to come home and we have a morale and an esprit de corps that no longer exists and needs repaired and built up from the ground. And I don't think that can happen with this kind of leadership. So no. we're looking several years down the road before that can even start, I think. But that's got to be first. You got to get soldiers wanting to be soldiers and caring about soldiers and
knowing if they go and do their job, they're going to be taken care of. The fact that even though they may not be soldiers because it was completely the opposite of what should have happened, the soldiers were pulled out first. If you're going to go serve your country, if you're going to do your duty, your country's got your back. We have betrayed that trust. And
that guarantee can't be made.
Yes.
Not today.
No, it's the same thing as what happens in a marriage. If one partner in the marriage goes out and betrays that trust, to regain that trust is not impossible, but really, really close.
Yeah, it's tough.
Yeah. We're in a tough spot, but we are Americans. We do love freedom. We do understand the ideal of what needs to happen. And just like the phoenix arose of the ashes, I believe that somewhere there will be at least a portion of us, maybe only 30 or 40%, maybe only 3%, will rise from the ashes, will reclaim this nation or start a new one. God forbid it has to come to that. But men like Bob are going to be the foundation of that.
I think that these next few years are gonna really we're gonna have to really pray and it's gonna be tough. We're gonna have a tough time. Our military's been hobbled. They've been crippled and castrated. And
how do you recruit someone to go risk their lives on foreign soil? For what?
For what is exactly right.
And the alternative to that is, okay, we wait until we're under attack here on our own soil and then try to put things together. Yeah, folks, we're in a tough spot.
Yeah, it's going to be tough. I don't know how, you know, we can't hide from this. It's out there. It's done deal. It's now a part of our history, and it now becomes something to learn from and move on.
One last thought, Bob. You had the time to go see Afghanistan. I was always told, in fact, we used to train for Korea in Wyoming, yeah, because we had the terrain, we had the, you know, the similarities were striking.
Well, and that was our capstone, which is a, that was our,
So, do you see a correlation between the people of Afghanistan and the terrain and the difficulty of conquering compared to, say, a little place like Wyoming?
Wyoming is so similar. So similar. A lot of the western states, a lot of, it's a high, semi-arid, rough, rugged Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, the western slope of Colorado, Utah.
Yeah.
The Badlands, that Wyoming is pretty much all Badlands. It's so similar.
You remember the comment that Biden made not too long ago about, well, if you want to take over the United States, you better have some nuclear weapons and you better have some F-14s. And I'm thinking, you know, the Taliban didn't have that.
Nope, they didn't. The one quote that really jumped out at me yesterday from our very loose term commander-in-chief, and I'm going to read it here so that maybe your listeners can remember hearing this. And this is a word for word quote. Jill and I, our hearts ache, like I'm sure all of you do as well, for all those Afghan families who lost loved ones, including small children, who have been wounded in this vicious attack, and were outraged as well as heartbroken. Not one mention of a U.S. military member.
Yeah.
Yeah, break my heart, Joe.
Yep. We probably should end it there before we get ourselves arrested.
Yeah, getting me fired up.
So. Bob, I love you.
I love you too, Ken. Thank you so much.
You bet. Take care, my friend.
All right. Have a good one.
Yep. Bye.
Bye.